Hello there, and welcome once again to the Turkey Book Talk podcast. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its region, which I've reviewed in the Hürriyet Daily News. You can subscribe to this podcast on a few different platforms, iTunes, Podbean, or Stitcher, or you can follow via the Turkey Book Talk Facebook page, or my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Apologies for the slight delay since publishing the last podcast. I've been struggling with a few technical problems that are hopefully now fixed. But my guest in this podcast is Mustafa Gürbüz, a policy fellow at George Mason University and adjunct lecturer at the American University in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Rival Kurdish Movements in Turkey, Transforming Ethnic Conflict, which is newly published by Amsterdam University Press. The book goes beyond the idea of the Turkish state versus the Kurds, instead examining local dynamics in southeast Turkey and competition between various actors, the PKK, pro-Kurdish political parties, the outlawed Islamic Kurdish militant group Hezbollah, and the Gulen movement. The book suggests that the rivalry between these groups often shapes the conflict and provides a path from violent to non-violent competition. I started by asking Mustafa about the idea of civic society competition and how his argument departs from traditional political moderation theory.
So in this book, I suggest going beyond the Turkish state versus Kurds and look at the local dynamics and look at other actors and analyze the complex local engagements. So the civic society competition and the culture of competition at the local levels could provide institutional mechanisms in which various Kurdish actors would see their best interests in reputation building as legitimate nonviolent actors instead of waging violence. Of course, you know, one could ask a legitimate question here, why the competition should be through nonviolence? Why not outbidding in violence instead? Why not compete to gain authenticity by furious attacks on the Turkish state? And this is the case for Hamas and PLO rivalry. And it's also recently explicit to us between Al-Qaeda and Daesh-ISIL rivalry. But such outbidding in violence is mostly observed in the emergence period of revolutionary groups, exemplified in the case of PKK in the early years, but not today. The nature of the contender groups in local contexts would also matter. Like the competition, PKK competes with Gulen, for example, nonviolent Gulen, and it could potentially destroy PKK's credibility if it goes too much violence in that competition. And take Hezbollah case. Why would Hezbollah try to outbid in violence? As the group is much weaker than the PKK, and moreover, it was nonviolent activism that paved way to the revival of Hezbollah from the ashes.
And in the book, you describe how this takes these forms. So different groups compete for public support. So, for example, ethnic nationalist groups soften their approach to religion, while religious groups, for example, those with links to Hezbollah, start to utilize ethnic Kurdish themes. Mm-hmm. What are some of the practical examples of this happening on the ground?
Right. What was a striking example to me is the competition over Kurdish Islam. So the Kurdish imams of the PKK, or maybe you can say the Kurdish party instead, you know, of HDP. And at that time, BDP, I was studying a few years ago. So Kurdish imams phenomena was seen as a tactical shift by many Islamic groups. But it turned out to be a strategic change along the way. In the early nascent form, in early 1990s, PKK's imams and engagement with Islam was more likely to be a tactical shift, so that they assumed that it's going to be, again, a kind of tactical short-term political strategy. But it has transformed into a long-term political strategy. It was explicit in the Öcalan's writings, in the peace message by Öcalan in the 2013, the peace process between the PKK and the Turkish state. So one, on the one hand, you see that an increasing religiosity, if you will, or expression of faith by the Marxist PKK revolutionaries. And on the other hand, it was interesting to see the language of Hezbollah is changing. And it was a kind of reaction to the PKK's reach to Islam, claiming that authenticity of Kurdish Islam, but through ethnic and symbolic nationalism. So when Hezbollah was defining Kurdish Islam, Hezbollah was defining itself as the Kurdish instead of highlighting the Islamic symbolism, because it's clear to everyone that Hezbollah is already in the Islamic sphere. And the PKK's approach to Kurdish Islam was more about the highlight of Islam in the revolutionary discourse. So one striking example was the Said Nursi figure. These two movements employed Said Nursi in an interesting way as a cultural rapporteur, I would say. Said Nursi was transformed into a revolutionary figure in the PKK discourse. And the Hezbollah discourse, Said Nursi was transformed into an ethnic leader like Sheikh Said. An Islamic and also an ethnic and primarily Kurdish figure. And it was, of course, these two narratives of Said Nursi, contestations over Said Nursi, was also a message to the Gülen movement. So a kind of local dynamic over Said Nursi symbolism was an expression of the competition over Kurdish Islam in the region.
And we should say that Said Nursi was a Kurdish, Turkish Islamic cleric in the 20th century.
Right, yes. It's interesting. Said Nursi was seen as the Gülen movement's intellectual figure for a long time, and also other Nur groups in the region, Nurcu and other small groups. But the point is, as I said, no one should expect that Hezbollah or PKK would claim Said Nursi in their writings. And Jamal Tutar, the military leader of Hezbollah, for example, put Said Nursi and Sheikh Said as the two prominent figures of Hezbollah's intellectual fathers, forefathers. And on the other hand, the Kurdish imams has a strong emphasis on Said Nursi at the local level. So it's not just something, a small tactic in a small town. It was a kind of long engagement with a symbolic figure, a historical figure in the larger context of Kurdish Islam, claiming Kurdish Islam.
Now, I want to talk about the elections and the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, or HDP. How was the unprecedented performance of the HDP in the June 2015 general election and the collapse of the peace process last summer related to this question of internal Kurdish dynamics? Many people have remarked on a possible dichotomy or rivalry between the HDP co-chair Selahattin Demirtas and the jailed PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan.
Well, if I go back to the initial phase of the peace process, we need to first put Öcalan into context, I guess, because Öcalan, as a captured leader of the PKK movement, has been making a balance between the radical flank, those who are the guerrilla leaders in the mountains, and the political leaders, politicians in the political party. So a balance between the two would mean a lot for Öcalan himself, because he is seen as a kind of opportunity for the state, and also the officials, they can negotiate with Öcalan. They can at least have a way to present him in the public, in the Turkish public. They cannot do it with the guerrilla leaders in that sense. So it was a kind of a balance between the two along the way, but the peace process itself was seen as a kind of opportunity for the Kurdish politician sessions to emphasize the nonviolent engagement and emphasize how they are vying for peace, supporting the united umbrella of a democratic Turkey, which fits to the picture of the democratic republic thesis of Abdullah Öcalan. And in my book, I especially give an emphasis on this particular issue of the internal competition of these pro-Kurdish actors. So the successful election campaigns in this year, HDP, after 2 years of peace ceasefire and or peace process, how you call it, was an outcome, was a fruit of this engagement. Look at the numbers, you know, 6.5% to 13%. They doubled the votes. They doubled the support and get the attention of Turkish left, get the support of many conservative Kurds. And these successful election campaigns are making the unprecedented reach and influence, especially for young leaders such as Selahattin Demirtas and Seri Süreyya Önder. They have gained prominence because they are increasingly perceived as reasonable actors for a permanent peace. Their ever-inclusive language draws votes from, as I said, both conservative Kurds and pro-secular Turks. So I'll come to the complexity of the issue here because PKK has a monopoly over Kurdish politics for quite some time. And this is not an easy shift to multivocality within the pro-Kurdish organizations. So the traditional prayers are, you know, now becoming replaced by a variety of actors under the forces of social competition. And, you know, it's going beyond Abdullah Öcalan. You know, it's Abdullah Öcalan has become a kind of symbolic figure, and the guerrilla forces and also the pro-Kurdish, you know, politicians, they have a more ability now, I guess, to play the game, so to speak. And one final point could be about the, you know, of the recent escalation of violence, you know, of the end of the peace process, because I feel that the PKK guerrilla leaders are now in a major internal competition to claim electoral victory in this summer. You know, they claim that it was their own victory, that should be highlighted. It was an unprecedented challenge to PKK hegemony, and I was in Diyarbakir the day of the election, the June election I'm talking about. Kurdish youth, they chant the slogans of guerrilla. You know, they I didn't hear Selahattin Demirtas. You know, it was kind of, I guess, a message to me that the youth organizations, primarily at the, you know, core activists I'm talking about, they are under the influence of more radical flanks, but maybe, you know, not the majority of youth, but, you know, the core, there's a competition. And, you know, the slogans was a clear message to me that the electoral, you know, this electoral victory would be claimed by both politicians as well as the guerrilla. And what was the message of the people? You know, the message was the nonviolence was as appreciated and embraced, or the PKK's resistance embraced or, you know, encouraged. So there is a kind of discursive competition going on, still going on, especially after the escalation of this this recent violence in the region.
Yeah, and then amid that escalation, there is this interesting dynamic that we're seeing again between armed Kurdish militant groups and the legal political parties. And in the news at the moment, the ruling AKP seems to be again planning to ban the pro-Kurdish HDP and lift the immunity of its MPs. And your book obviously is about this kind of process of civicization of Kurdish activism. I mean, what in this context, what do you think is the prospect that Kurdish actors can get back into this dynamic that you describe of non-violent civil society competition?
Well, two things in this question, I guess. One is about the how to approach these linkages between moderate parties and the radical flanks. You know, if there are some links, how the state authorities should approach this. And the second thing is about the, you know, revival of the civic competition in which an AKP is an actor. So, you know, so I'll come to that complexity. Should I go and talk about the linkage between these parties, moderate and radical flanks?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Well, we need to understand that this problem is not peculiar to Kurdish case. So in general, revolutionary movements develop a twofold strategy. On the one hand, they maintain a strong guerrilla forces to wage violence against the state authorities. On the other hand, though, they aim to build institutional bases in the civil society. So the political parties or the nonviolent organizations are like this. And while in my book, I argue that increasing institutional activism in the civic sphere enables revolutionaries to build both legitimacy and institutional credibility. And when they gain credibility, they are having benefits of this tactical shift towards moderation. And as they benefit more, they see their interest in nonviolent activism, it could turn into a strategy along the way. And also their institutional resources, you know, the personnel and the money and so forth, these material resources also transformed. So the issue needs to be seen as how we can make these radicals get engaged and how to make them understand that their best interest in nonviolent activism. So the question is it, you know, okay to just have this double strategy? My argument is that we need to be developing a smart strategy and understand the civic organization's nature. Strategic engagement appears to be the key to transforming ethnic conflicts. So let me put this, the PKK didn't have to make an Islamic opening. Likewise, Hezbollah was not forced into publishing pro-Kurdish journals. It's true that the larger context encouraged these actors' decisions, but these strategic moves were not necessary. So these, you know, ideological movements often reluctant to pursue such broader engagement strategies because of their deep concern for keeping the purity of their ideologies. But, you know, these movements in this context could take courageous steps to make a strategic engagement. And that strategic engagement and agents' choices could be extremely significant in the final outcomes. So moderation can emerge in an active field of civic competition. And the other question, how the civic competition could be revived after this disturbances like we had in the past few months, violent escalation and so forth. So there are major challenges to revive the peace process because of the increasing mistrust between the parties now. This is a big challenge because, you know, the same people, same faces, you know, and increasing mistrust between parties. This is a big challenge for a true peace process. But the first step right now should be seeking a ceasefire, even for a tactical one. One of the premises in conflict transformation literature is that a small tactical step could turn into a strategy. So for the future prospects of the civic competition, electoral strategies will be the key. There will be competition for legitimacy as long as conservative party like AKP or other mainstream party vying for Kurdish votes. This is critical. And the second critical thing is the emergence of strong political leaders, moderate voices such as Demirtas and others. So I call this era, the upcoming era, as the post-Öcalan era in Kurdish politics. They have a more charismatic voice among Kurdish youth as well as Turkish leftist youth. And this is an important asset.
Yeah. But I mean, Öcalan is still this kind of totemic figure, isn't he? I mean, all activists constantly invoke him, and even these new generations that you see in the urban centres in Cizre and whatnot, they're still always, you know that if Öcalan said the word, his word is the order. Even now, it seems always amazing to me that this is still the case with these new generations that have only ever known him in prison. He still has this kind of totemic, you know, symbolic importance.
Well, that's a good point. As I earlier mentioned, how Öcalan plays the game, so to speak, you know, a balance between the two is needed for Öcalan. So I expect that a ceasefire, if there is a ceasefire coming, it will be through the channel of Öcalan, because that's the only channel that could make the politicians as well as the guerrilla forces could utilize. And you know, and also the state and the, you know, AKP leaders could utilize. So there's still, as you mentioned, that a channel through Öcalan. But the point is, Öcalan is more a totemic figure, as you mentioned, through that symbolism, that becoming a channel. But how about the, you know, local dynamics within the party, within the, you know, mountains, and also the changes in the Syrian politics and the PYDs, you know, that is also shaping the region, you know, the cantons. You know, it's really beyond Öcalan. So that's what I meant.
And you mentioned there the regional situation that I want to talk about, because it does seem to be growing in importance, the situation across the border in Syria, and how the Kurdish militant groups there are relating to the militant groups in Turkey. I mean, how do you think these regional dynamics have shaped the issue up to today and will shape the Kurdish issue in Turkey in the near future?
Well, that's a very good and challenging question, especially after the Syrian war. The Kurdish issue has become a global phenomenon. So it might be really interesting, I think, at this point, after writing this book, to look at the competition, regional competition at large. It would be a kind of interesting project, I'm thinking, like the Barzani's KDP's competition with the PYD and PKK. So yes, this is regional competition is the key also to understand the southeastern Turkey. So the Turkey's Kurdish problem needs to be seen in the larger context. Well, let me put this. In the next decade, I expect these global and local dynamics would enable Kurdish actors expressing their self-determination points more clearly, all of them. They will be more, they're emboldened, they will be more powerful in terms of their discourse, in terms of their resources to claim self-determination right. If we look at cantons, Syrian Kurdish cantons at Turkey's borders, they are now increasingly perceived as a legitimate local governments by the international community. Turkey may not accept this at this point, but this is the case at large. So in Europe, in the West, in the States, this is a big shift. Let me give one example. After the fight against ISIS, it is really secularism of Kurds, or the self-determination as a kind of safe haven, secular safe haven in the Middle East. This is a very interesting, you know, dynamic to see. There are some local and global implications for this. And local implication is that the AKP is seen as a kind of radical, more radical Islamist actor, you know, with the ISIS, with the radical flanks, you know, in Syria, al-Nusra and others. It is the depiction, I mean, it is the discourse I'm looking at. And the, you know, secular self-determination claim get the Western elite support in the wake of radical Islamist threat. So the claim of democratic local governance in Syria is tied to the Turkish context, I mean, and that is really an interesting development. So I expect the Kurdish ethno-nationalism has become symbolically and resourcefully powerful than ever before. And so it's highly possible to me, seeing that a de facto autonomy in Kurds, autonomy of Kurds in Syria, de facto, I mean, like the initial phase of KRG region in Iraq. So how about the southeastern Turkey then? Yeah, you know, there would be consequences, and it could inevitably lead southeast becoming more independent in its governance at local levels, at least. But European models of federalism, Well, there are big challenges. You know, it will be discussed in the most heated fashion, I expect, in the next decade. But the holding for a plebiscite like Scotland's seems unlikely. Such an official change in Turkey, in Turkish policy, may only be seen after a formally independent Kurdistan in the northern Iraq. And you know, especially this challenge of Syria, it's not really coming in upcoming years. I guess Turkish policy again wouldn't accept an independent Kurdistan in Syria. Maybe at first, as I said, first one would be probably for Turks. If there would be a step toward that direction, they will make it with TRG instead of the other way. But it will be again a process to watch.
That was Mustafa Gürbüz talking about his book Rival Kurdish Movements in Turkey: Transforming Ethnic Conflict. You can find a link to my review of the book via armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. On there I've also posted links to other pieces you may be interested in, including an earlier interview I did with Mustafa discussing Hezbollah. And you can subscribe to this podcast via iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher. If you like the podcast, please feel free to rate it on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can like the Turkey Book Talk Facebook page. But in the meantime, thank you very much for listening.